just said that, gee, he wound up getting the Medal of Freedom something from the president because he made the call. He knew what that meant, and he told the flight, go ahead, and they did. In fact, he did.
I had that lady at MIT not set up that operating system to set priorities. And there's some fancy words for that, which I don't know. That computer would have simply been overloaded. It would have no longer given them the guidance information to land at the right spot. And so, complicated process, and they came very close to getting into an awful lot of trouble. Brave guys. Okay, I know we've drifted pretty far left of center of electromagnetic pulse and repeaters, but hopefully, you said it was KD2 Whiskey Delta Sierra. That may not be his call letters, John. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Thank you, fucking guys, go.
KC2WGB. I only read what was on the screen, the KD2WDS, but may have made an error, that's true. Very good information, something that we haven't heard before. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next question.
You got...
Talk about phone. Try it.
Am I getting over that, Dick?
You're getting over it beautifully. Go right ahead, John.
All right, John.
Okay. All right, we have a gentleman here who has purchased at a very reasonable price. As you know, these things are becoming cheaper and cheaper. A return loss bridge. Very simple, passive device. He'd like to know, what is it used for? What does it measure? You know, all the operating parameters, if you can. He'd like to know, what loss are you actually measuring? Why is it called a return loss bridge? So he has no clue of what it does. So maybe you can help him out with that, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
What is it?
When it comes to a transmission line connected to an antenna, what we desire is for the signal coming out of the transmitter to flow down the transmission line once, to go into the antenna, and be radiated. The craziness of the way a transmission line behaves is if your transmission line is the kind that's called 50-ohm impedance, it wants to see a resistive load at the antenna, it wants the antenna to acclimate to a 50-ohm resistor. If the antenna lacks like any other resistance value, higher or lower than 50 ohms, or if there's any amount of reactance at the antenna, that means it acts a little bit like a capacitor or an inductor, a certain percentage of the power will reflect off the antenna, not be absorbed by the antenna, and come back down the cable. So a return loss bridge is another name for a kind of standing wave ratio indicator. Your Berg wattmeter gives you the ability to measure forward power and reverse power by flipping that slug. There's various kinds of Wheatstone bridge, return loss bridge, standing wave ratio indicators. Every one of these are looking at the exact same thing. So is a vector network analyzer. So is a Smith chart. In all of these cases, given a lot of fancy words, a lot of different ways of setting up the hardware. Let me drop. A lot of different ways of setting up the hardware, but it all boils down to the exact same factor. Any mismatch in the impedance at the far end of the transmission line is going to create a calculatable, a quantifiable amount of signal reflecting back down. And if you've got the right kind of instrumentation where you can measure what is the exact impedance of the antenna, you'd like the antenna to be a 50-ohm resistor. Maybe your particular antenna is a 25-ohm resistor in series with a 10-ohm capacitor. That's a very specific impedance. By way of a Smith chart and mathematics and other techniques, that exact impedance that can be measured creates an amount of reflected signal where the amplitude of the reflected signal is known ahead of time and the phase angle of the signal is known ahead of time. So once you measure those resulting reflecting signals back at the transmitter end, you know an awful lot of information about what's going on. A vector network analyzer is one of the instruments that does that in a very exacting manner. A return loss bridge gives you a quantitative answer, what we call a scalar answer. In other words, it tells you amplitude of reflecting. That tells you the exact amount of standing wave ratio. A 9.5 dB reflection, for instance, is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Let me drop. And there are charts you can look up where that tells you that. But standing wave ratio is a very important measurement. It's one of the quickest ways you can get a health measurement, a report card as to how well your antenna is working with your particular transmission line, and is it likely to keep the transmitter happy. These so-called no-tune modern transmitters are nice and compact, but they're pretty persnickety. Many of the HF transmitters these days, if they see more than a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio, start going into a self-protect procedure, cutting back power output, turning off the final stage, whatever. And so return loss bridge is one of the instruments that's helped you make that measurement. And so the first time you start hearing, let me drop. The first time you start hearing these words and vocabulary about standing wave ratio, it's going to snow you. If you're frustrated by the first few times you hear it, you're in good company. We've all gone through that exact same procedure. I can remember the first time I was exposed to it in the college course I went to. I said, why in the world do I have to know this? How many times have we all said that? Why in the world do I have to know this? I'm not going to work in that area. Well, later on in my life, it became very important. So if you can plow through it and learn what it means and how to correct it, it is a good piece of information to know and retain, and it is important. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, that's a great little item to have, and they are relatively cheap, and you can do a lot with it. I know Joe, RYY, works with them a lot, and he seems to do pretty well with it. And by the way, you were right. The call sign is corrected now. It's KD2PWS. So I thanked him for that question. And, okay, I think we should go over to Paul. It's quarter after almost, and we'll see what's happening. I can't wait to hear about that landing. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
And was there any Echolink activity? Anybody trying to sign in that weren't able to make it? And did anybody issue any questions to your screen on Echolink tonight? John, go ahead.
Yes, Dick, we had about 8-9 people. They come in and out, and this one DWS came in on Echolink that question, so I thank him for that.
Okay, Paul's up at bat next. And this is, I think, going to be space report number 181 of the series from Paul. And, boy, that SpaceX company, I bet you they opened up a number of champagne bottles this week, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, and TechNet.
This is WS2N. Yeah, two of the stories we covered last week came out the next day, you know, and it was solved right after the net. And one of them was the spacewalk that they came up with, unscheduled spacewalk for two astronauts, American astronauts, to go out and move the mobile transporter, make sure they could get it to a different location to a docked position where that thing wouldn't move around. And we were wondering if the brakes were locked, and that was the first thing he was going to look at, to see if there was a handle that they could lift up to release the brakes. Otherwise, they were going to go through a complicated procedure, taking things apart and down to the wheels. They didn't have to do that. The movement of that one lever took care of that problem. And they have plenty of time left to do get-ahead work for other things, you know, other equipment that has to be installed on the space station. But the other topic that we talked about, we're wondering if the FAA was going to give Elon Musk with SpaceX the approval to land his booster back at Cape Canaveral, which it turns out he did. He got that approval 7 hours before the actual launch time. So, you know, they had the computer set where if they didn't get the approval, they were going to try to land the booster back on a barge out in the ocean. But since he did, they set it all up, and they launched on time, and it was actually during the ClubNet on Monday night. And it was around 11:30, a little after 11:30 when that happened, when it took off. And the idea was to put 11 satellites in space by Orbcomm. I mean, they get paid for this. The taxpayer didn't have to pay 10 cents for this mission. It was launched on time. They were going to put the satellites into a 400-mile-high orbit. These small satellites, what they're designed for is machine-to-machine communications. For instance, the truck on a road communicating back to where, you know, their headquarters, that type of thing, or a ship out in the middle of the sea. And Orbcomm has many satellites up there. I think now they're up to a little over 30 with the 11 that SpaceX put up there. That was the goal, to put those things up. In doing that, that was their first rocket since, you know, SpaceX first rocket since back in June when they had the failure when they were launching cargo up to the International Space Station. And that rocket failed, and due to a bad steel strut on the inside of the second stage that broke loose and sent a helium tank moving and exploding inside the exploded the second stage, and that was the end of that mission. Very successful flight for a comeback. To take this new rocket, the new Falcon 9, it's longer than the old one. They call it the full thrust. You know, the official name was the Falcon 1.2. You know, there's been a Falcon 1, a Falcon 1.1, and now this is the Falcon 1.2. And to eliminate that nomenclature, they're just calling it the full thrust Falcon 9. It gets off the launch pad on time, no delays. They did want to do it a day or two earlier, but they felt the winds and, you know, would be better conditions the next night. And Orbcomm, they didn't complain. The people that were paying the bill. So sure enough, they got the okay from the FAA to launch. It went up. 2 minutes or so into flight, the main engine cuts off, sends the second stage and the payload onto its orbit. Now, by that time, it's going 4,000 miles per hour, so it's at a hypervelocity. They have a nitrogen charged rocket jets near the top of this thing. The top of the first stage. Now you got to remember, this first stage is 156 feet high. The whole stack is 229 feet high. So imagine a 159 foot thing that's roughly 12 feet in diameter. You know, you could imagine some of us have tall antenna towers. You know, maybe 50 feet high or maybe 100 feet high. This thing's 100. The first stage is 156 feet high. The whole thing is 229 feet high. This whole setup is now going 4,000 miles an hour. The stage separates, and they also had a longer cone or a bell-shaped cone on the second stage, so that was new too. But to accommodate that, they needed a new pusher system. So that pusher system had to work as well to separate the stages.
Since that worked out okay, the second stage lit up and took the rest of the satellite to orbit. But this first stage did a 180 pirouette in space. The three of the nine stages come back to life and start slowing the first stage down, and it starts boosting back toward Cape Canaveral and slowing itself down, getting down below the eventually below the speed of sound. It does a 90 degree pitch, starts coming back straight down toward toward the ground, and with that the engines fire one more time to try to slow it down. Three engines. At that point, it was successful. Now that people could see it, now this is all being done at night. I mean, it launched at night. Remember, it's during the winter time, so it was 8:30 at night. It was already dark when it took off, and now you could see a bright light coming back down. Naturally, the people in Mission Control in Hawthorne, California, were going nuts. That's where Mission Control is for the SpaceX. There are thousands of people in there, out there screaming, and then. Sure enough, gets closer to the launch pad, the landing pad. Now, landing pad is called now, it used to be Launch Complex 13. Well, SpaceX bought it up. They operate this whole thing now. They demolished everything that was there, and they put in a big landing field all made out of concrete. And it's like about five times bigger than one of these autonomous barges that are out there. So it's a big landing field. You know, in case they were off a little bit. In the middle of this big piece of concrete, they have this big SpaceX, this big X. You know, X marks the spot. So, you know, for SpaceX. So, this thing came down, and you could see it, and then it landed in its dead center. But to even get to this point, right before that, these fins, these hydraulically operated fins open up near the top of the spacecraft to slow it down toward that last little, you know, couple of, maybe a thousand feet. And, you know, it really catches the air, and it guides itself over to this center mark. And as it was coming down, the final stage ignites. At the same time, the four legs open up. Big, you know, it's a 60-foot leg span. 30 feet on each side. They pop open, and this just the center stage is now ignited. You know, you have an octaweb, you have nine engines, so it's just the center one now going and coming down, and it landed right dead center. I mean, right in the middle. You know, he hit a bullseye. That was pretty much it. Let me drop it. Until they switch back to the rest of the mission, and they show the in flight they show the second stage lit up. You know, you could still see it; it's still firing. It had like a 10-minute burn left to go, and that eventually cut off, separated the payload. The payload also had a camera on board. And they showed all 11 satellites from 400 miles up. And, who knows where, I guess over Europe or something by now, just separating from the whole setup. And they weren't done there. They wanted to reignite the second stage and bring that down. And they unnecessary to do it, but they wanted to show that they could reignite it, because in future flights, they need to be able to do that to create a circular circular orbit when they do geosynchronous flights. And that second stage came down and wound up going into the Indian Ocean, I believe. So that's that was it. They did quite a job. Back to you, Dick, for any comments. This is WS2N, space portion of the TechNet.
Sure is well done. Do you have reason to believe, Paul, that SpaceX will be landing the majority of their first stage boosters back at Kennedy Space Center or Cape Canaveral, which, by the way, are two separate places, in the same vicinity, but two separate facilities. And I'm guessing that the second stage booster, there is no option to bring that one back. But the first stage booster, certainly there's a lot of really great big hardware, and it's darn economical to get that back. So sounds to me like Musk is going to be doing that from now on. Of all the other vendors of space hardware, are they now also taking a hard look at returning that first stage? And I'm guessing that nobody has the option of returning the second stage. Give me some words on this, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, and Cape Kennedy and Cape Canaveral. Two different locations toward the north. You have Cape Kennedy. That's where the vehicle assembly building is. That's where your 3 mile runway is that the shuttles always landed at. That's where Pad 39A and Pad 39B, actually twins, two different pads, are located when you launched all your shuttles. And years before that, you used to launch your Apollo 11 type flights to the moon. Then you have further south, and you go into further south in Merritt Island, and you get into the Air Force owned location of Cape Canaveral, where you have all these different launch pads. And that's where they launched from SpaceX. They took over Launch Complex 40, and that's where they've been launching their unmanned spacecraft from the last couple of years. They also now took over Space Complex number 13 and created a landing field out of it. And they now call that Landing Zone 1, you know. So they changed their name. And as far as the second stage is coming back, its long-term plan is to eventually bring the second stage back. It is a goal, you know, I mean, many years from now, plans on eventually incorporating a heat shield to it. You know, let it go up for like 24 hours, maybe eight orbits, and, you know, communication devices on it, and eventually bring that back. His goal is to do that. His goal is full reusability. Naturally, he already has reusability with the cargo. With the cargo Dragon, he's the only one American company capable of doing that, bringing the spacecraft back. He brings things back from the space station, all the science equipment.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Let me drop it. This new booster is going to be used on a regular basis. This is the one that he cryogenically cooled the temperature of the oxygen and the RP-1, the kerosene fuel, down roughly 50 degrees in each case, 50 degrees lower than what you would normally have it at. Molecules are closer together. It's called densification, so he's able to get more volume out of it. The increased length of the second stage, roughly 5 feet longer. He needed a longer tank. By doing that, he's able to save more fuel on the first stage and return that first stage back to Cape Canaveral. And his goal is to, yeah, on every flight, he would like to bring everything back. If they're designed like this, the orbit is designed the way this one is, they could bring them all back to Cape Canaveral. If they plan on sending them further into geosynchronous orbit, further downrange before the first stage separates, let me drop it. He knows he has the option of landing it on a barge. He still has that plan. When you get up to around, let's see, 4-5 months from now, probably May, maybe June at the latest, I hope, he plans on launching the Falcon 9 Heavy. What that is three Falcon 9s really strapped together, using two of them as boosters, liquid fuel boosters, plus another stage on top of that for the which what normally is the second stage would become the third stage. So he's going to have two boosters come back to Landing Zone 1, and he'll have landing zone 2. And then the third booster will be going too far downrange on the heavy, and he plans on bringing that back to an autonomous barge, Dick. So, incredible. I mean, is there other companies planning on this? Let me drop it. Have Jeff Bezos in charge of Amazon.com. He's another billionaire with, you know, really going nuts with his space program, and he's got the Blue Origin going. He back in November launched a rocket called New Shepard by his Blue Origin company, and launched it suborbital. You know, big difference than what we just described here. Didn't put anything to orbit. He got up to a little over 100 kilometers, which is past the Kármán line, so it's officially in space. Separated the capsule. Someday, eventually, the capsule will be able to handle people, and they'll be able to do suborbital flights. Well, the first stage came back and landed vertically, you know, vertical landing as well, and did that in New Mexico. Texas. He did that in Texas. That's where he's located. So that thing did do the same thing. There's a big difference. I mean, the booster itself is like, I don't know, 50 feet high tops. This thing's 156 feet high. His booster is one rocket. It's just, you know, one engine. Let me drop it. This thing got like 120,000 pounds of thrust. Elon Musk with SpaceX, you're running 9 engines plus a second stage, which is really another Merlin engine. Really running 10 engines. And at liftoff, you're pushing, I guess 1.6 million pounds of thrust. So you're talking about a big difference. Other companies like the ULA, United Launch Alliance, which is composed of Lockheed and Boeing, are now thinking about reusability. They're thinking about launching their new rocket. They have one called the Vulcan rocket that they're building. Probably be ready 5 years from now to replace the Atlas. Want to replace the Atlas V. So ULA is going to probably... they're thinking about having their engines, not the booster itself, but the engines separate, come back on parachutes, and they're going to grab those things as they're flying through the air before they hit the water, and then bring them back to land. They're thinking about that. Ariane Space, they've got some ideas, but nothing concrete. Nobody is as far along as Elon Musk. I remember 5, 8, maybe 10 years ago, he was talking about reusability, and he says if he can't reuse at least the first stage, if he can't get total reusability, he's going to consider his whole effort a failure. Back to you, Dick. WS2F.
Ask a question, Antonio.
Go right ahead, Rich.
Hey, good evening, everybody. I believe I just woke up a little while ago. Paul, I know what I mentioned this before. Is there any chance, in your opinion, and it's only even an opinion of yours, that SpaceX will go public? I think it would be a good investment. Over to you, Paul. Dick, I know this is a direct net. Over to you, Dick.
You got it, Paul. We ain't that official around here. You got it, Paul.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to blow any more money on this, Rich, that's for sure. Because normally I wouldn't comment because I would say either buy it or don't buy it. You can't do that on ham radio. But I can tell you the history of what he's got planned, what his future history is. He has no intention of making SpaceX public from what I've read. I've read it in a couple of places. In fact, anything I report, I try to read it at least two or three places. His goal, you know, it sounds far-fetched, is he wants to go to Mars. That's it. He's going to Mars. After the Falcon 9 project, he's got a plan for the Raptor engine, the Raptor rocket, and which is going to be, like, to give you an idea, the diameter of this thing is roughly about 12 feet, you know, triple that. The height is going to be enormous. It's going to be like the Saturn V. The thrust coming out of his Raptor engines collectively could be, more than the SLS being built by NASA, the Space Launch System. And his goal is he wants to be able to send spacecraft to Mars. I mean, lots of spacecraft. In fact, whole colonies. He wants to call this big rocket that I was just talking about someday down the road, if he ever gets around to build it, the Mars Colony Transport. So to answer your question, Rich, he has no intention of going public until he has people in colony. You know, he's setting up a colony on Mars. So we got a long way before you could become a partner. Back to you, I guess, Dick, WS2M.
Hey, fine, Paul. There's been a couple of reports this week about the Oak Ridge National Laboratory being turned back on to generate plutonium-238 fuel, which is what's used for the nuclear power supplies on things like Curiosity and Voyager and Kepler. I don't think Kepler, but a number of spacecraft that go far out where the sun doesn't shine very much and solar cells are essentially out of the question, or in the case of a Mars roving craft, you don't want to be towing this great big sail of solar cells on that craft that's crawling around on Mars. So it's running on nuclear power. And so the amount of plutonium-238 that the United States has stockpiled is very limited. And so NASA is worrying about future deep space missions. Will there be enough fuel available? And so Oak Ridge is being turned back on to try to support that effort. Let me drop.
Comment, Dick?
Okay, yeah, go right ahead there, John.
Oak Ridge didn't develop plutonium. That was done in near Olympic, Washington, which is a highly contaminated site. So I guess they're going to build a new one. Is that what you heard?
No. The Washington site was making the plutonium, which is a different isotope that's used for nuclear weapons. Plutonium-238 was a byproduct of that process. It just turns out it has 87-year lifespan, or a half-life, and therefore makes a very desirable fuel for a nuclear thermal electric generator for generating electricity as well as heat to run things. The United States also has stockpiled a number of kilograms of, I think it's called Neptunium-239, and there's a way that Oak Ridge can convert that to plutonium-238. So plutonium-38 is not a weapons-grade plutonium, but it's a beautiful material for doing these nuclear thermal electric power generators that last for lots of years and can run in deep space. So what I'm getting at is that there's a very limited supply of this desirable material. And now Oak Ridge and one other facility has been turned back on to get back into the production for spacecraft, not for weapons. But one of the reports I read is that Curiosity has 4.8 kilograms of plutonium-238 on its thermal electric generator, which is a lot, and it's only making 125 watts of electrical power. Let me drop. So Curiosity is running on 125 watts of electrical power and a couple of hundred watts of thermal energy coming off of it, which is keeping things warm during the Mars night, which goes down to some really cold temperatures that could be doing damage to some of the instruments. So 4.8 kilograms on Curiosity, to generate 125 watts of electrical power. Voyager, launched in 1977, is generating something like 380 or 400 watts of electrical power when it was new, and is down to 200 or so watts now. And nowhere can I read the number of kilograms of plutonium that's in that power supply. If one of the really big power supplies was Curiosity at 4.8 kilograms, and it's only generating 125 watts, and Curiosity, to repeat, is generating two or three times that amount of electrical power, but nobody will tell you how many pounds of plutonium are on that craft. So, as you can see, there's a little bit of a mystery there. Now, maybe there's a very, very difference in the design as to what percentage is dedicated to electrical generation versus thermal generation to keep things warm. N2XJ and WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I know. I know. I read the whole setup on that years ago. What is it? Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 have three thermoelectric generators on board. When they made these things, they made them all about the same size. And by the way, they tested the canisters. They shot these canisters out of cannons on aircraft and duplicated what it would be like if these things crash landed on the Earth. You just can't break these canisters open. But they're all about the same. And I thought it was 103 watts. Each one is 103 watts. So Voyager started out with three of these things. And you can see them. If you look up a picture of Voyager, you get a close-up of it, you can see the three of them. Everybody thinks it's all the way out on that end of the, they have like a little truss second going out about 50 feet. It's not. It's located near the body of the spacecraft. You can see these three different sphere setup things, and each one is a RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator. Horizon had two, so they pushed out a little over 200 watts. Curiosity is one, and they just, that's why they're getting, I heard 103 watts. I also heard 9 pounds, so I guess that's close to your 4 point something kilograms. And the amount of spacecraft that we've had that have used this metropolis are very few. They actually used one going to the moon. Apollo 12 bought one up for their all those piece of equipment that they left behind. They were running off of that. Still are, I think. You've got Ulysses. That did a polar orbits around the sun. Went out to Jupiter, changed its trajectory, wound up going to in polar orbits around the sun. That had an RTG on it. The two Pioneer spacecraft also that left the solar system. They're running RTGs. I think they had three on them as well. I have to look back. They had a lot of power. Cassini, of course, the one going around Saturn right now, coming to the end of its mission after going around Saturn for about 10 years. It went into orbit in 2004. Still operating on the RTG. I think you got about another year or two left of Cassini. Galileo had one. That was the one that orbited Jupiter for many years. And I think that's about it, Dick. Back to you.
Interesting. I'm getting the impression that there is a standard module of 110 watts, I'm going to say, of an RTG. And depending on how much power you need, you use one, two, or three of them, of that standard design. That's a very, very cute technique if that's what's being done. But if I start adding up the total number of pounds, kilograms, of plutonium-238 that's used on all of these missions versus the number of pounds we have stockpiled right now and the rate at which they can reproduce it, boy, we've burned up an awful lot. We've used up an awful lot in the last 10 or 15 or 20 years. Well, if I include Voyager 33 years, I guess it is, or 35 years, something like that, 1977. Interesting. So it sounds like it's a standard design. And that's a great way to go when you're going deep into space and solar cells are not going to do it for you. Expensive, but you don't have any choice. And I guess the package itself, what they said about plutonium-238, which makes it so desirable. Let me drop. Is that it emits nothing but protons, if I understand correctly. I think it's protons it emits. Those protons, those alpha particles, can be stopped with a piece of paper. So the even though you've got a nuclear power supply on board, you would think that, okay, we're irradiating all of the instruments on board, and we got to protect the instruments from this power supply. I think the power supply is very safe, is my understanding. So it gives you lots of heat for a lot of time, and with the thermocouples, you can convert that heat into electricity, and you get a lot of electricity for a whole lot of time. It's a great combination, and it's not weapons-grade plutonium. It's a different isotope. And so we're suddenly realizing how valuable that material is, and they're reestablishing the techniques for generating more of it, because the amount we've got right now is essentially a byproduct of the weapons production of the previous, 50 years or so. And because we know that there are three of those generators on board, and we know how many kilograms is in each generator, we can therefore easily estimate how much is on Voyager. And it's a good number. Over to you, Paul, for any corrections on all of the above. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, NASA knows exactly how many pounds they have left. And I read it at one time, I don't remember. But it's not much. Enough for maybe two different spacecraft to go up. So they're thinking about now that they've got the budget, $19 billion for NASA, one of the missions they're thinking about using it on would be the Europa Express mission. Pretty much after that, it's shot. So now they did say, well, maybe the military has some that they're not telling them about. Well, it doesn't help them if they're not going to give it to them. So I think it's good. I didn't read that they were going to bring back the production of 238. They got better with the solar cells. For instance, Rosetta went out to way past Mars, you know, out to the asteroid belt, and that's running on very large solar cells. And at one time, they didn't think that you could do it past Mars. You could do it up to Jupiter. In fact, we have this year, Juno will be going into polar orbit around Jupiter, and that has solar cells as well. The last thing that we launched was New Horizon, and that's okay. About, 4 years from now, it'll be going past another Kuiper belt. One other thing I wanted to mention, there's so many things on this list, you know, I don't want to kill the net with the space report, but the mission Insight was planned on being launched to Mars in January. That's being canceled, and for reasons I could tell you if you want to get into it, it's a vacuum problem with one of the cylinders. I don't know if you read that, Dick.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So maybe it'll go in 2018. Back either.
Yeah, I think I also read about Insight being canceled. I guess there's a limit on funds. And when you look at the history, for instance, of James Webb, a very valuable infrared optical telescope, the successor to Hubble. Hubble, by my standards, Hubble is the most productive piece of space hardware NASA has ever produced. You know, the United States public, really, the whole world, really identifies with that thing and the fantastic pictures it can take. And James Webb, many times bigger, is going to have a lot more capability for a couple of reasons. A bigger mirror, infrared, greater penetration, more sensitive instruments, more cryogenics, and so on. I was worried about how much nuclear fuel was going to be on James Webb, and as I dug a little bit deeper, I found out James Webb Space Telescope is going to be running on solar cells, so it doesn't need nuclear fuel. Now, Europa Express, let me drop the four Galileo moons of Jupiter, Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto. Europa, I think, is the one. I think it's the second one out. I think it's the one that's got this hard shell of ice on the outside, and they believe there's liquid water on the inside. So is the Europa Express going to go to Europa to try to do a search for potential life in that fluid below the surface of Europa? I'm making a bunch of guesses here, but I think if I haven't mixed up my moons, I think Europa is the one that they believe has liquid water below the frozen surface. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Long-term goal for Europa would be to land there and somehow bore through a mile of ice or whatever it is and try to get into the surface, the ocean that is believed to be there, and send a submarine in. You know, it is all kinds of long-term plans, but the immediate plans for the Europa Express is to launch a rocket from here to go into orbit around Jupiter, not around Europa, but around Jupiter. And the idea would be to, you know, orbit Jupiter and come as close to Europa as possible. And they plan on 44 different passes, you know, over the years when it's around, you know, going around orbit around Jupiter. And those 44 passes would be, you know, close enough for what they want to investigate. That was the initial plan, but now that they wound up with more money than they originally planned on, they might get a go-ahead, naturally, because, you know, the scientists, you know, they want everything. And because now they do have a little bit more money, they plan on sending a lander down, and what they're going to do with it when it gets there, I don't know yet, but they are planning on sending a probe down to Europa. So that would be good. And as far as InSight goes, they're not canceling because of money. It's technical. They cannot find a vacuum leak in one of the detectors. The main part of InSight is seismology on Mars. And France is building this one detector, and no matter what they did, they cannot solve this leak out of this sphere that's on board the spacecraft. And they ran...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Next. I timed it out, Dick.
We only lost 2 seconds, Paul. Not to worry. So, you would think that a leak in a detector... Obviously, the detector is a very expensive assembly. You don't just go out and build another one, and you can't find the leak that's in it. Oh, well. Europa Express is now becoming a more significant spacecraft because there's more money, and the scientists want to do more. And wouldn't that be something if the first place that we discover life in our solar system, other than the Earth, is on the second moon of Jupiter? And so what is the current schedule, Paul? Europa Express, if all goes well, does that get launched in 4 years? Got any guess on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Probably 2022, something like that. Launch time. Long time from now. Got plenty of time to think about it. I know you like all these numbers, but this the pressure inside that sphere, they need to maintain a pressure of 10 to the minus 7 bar, you know, bar being one atmosphere. So there you go, 10 to the minus 7. I remember writing it down, but I didn't give it much thought. I know it's extremely low pressure. And even so, you have one-tenth of 1 pound of pressure on Mars, I would have thought, well, that's practically a vacuum anyway. It's not even close to what they need for this detector and on InSight. And they had one of the sensors that are going into the sphere was leaking. They spent a couple of months trying to fix that. Then they realized that another leak had occurred at a different location on another sensor. And then on the tube that they you know, when they pull a vacuum on this, they eventually seal that tube. That tube piece was actually leaking, so they ran out of time. Back to you.
Yeah, the word leak has got some very relative words to it. You and I building a piece of electronics inside of a box would use a nice, strong rubber seal to hold down the cover to keep the weather out of the box. By space standards, by modern-day fancy detector standards, a rubber seal is not a seal at all. It's not a hermetic seal. It's only a weather seal. A lot of gases will walk right through that rubber. We've all had the problem of a helium-filled balloon that you buy today, and you have the string tied to the bedpost, and by tomorrow morning, it might not be up to the ceiling anymore. The helium leaks out of the rubber. Well, when you do a helium leak test, when you think you've got a hermetically sealed package, where everything in the package is welded metal, the metal cover is welded down, and the only places where you're bringing in voltages is going through a glass seal. And you would think a glass seal and welded cover would really be sealed. Well, you do a helium leak test on that, and you measure the rate at which the helium molecules come out of that package. They migrate through that glass, through that steel, whatever. So when it comes to helium, a very small molecule, it walks right through an awful lot of things that you think it wouldn't. It could walk through a wall very slowly, but it does it continuously. So my guess, let me drop. My guess is that InSight, in the process of manufacturing that fancy detector, they may have used materials that were not quite as good at creating hermeticity, a hermetic seal. You can't just use any old kind of glass and any old kind of weld and whatever if you really want a tight seal, if you want to keep all of the gases of interest either inside or outside. So they may have had to give up on it because on further investigation, if there's more than one detector that's leaking, that sounds to me not a manufacturing mistake, but a choice of materials mistake. And to replace those materials is probably as difficult as just starting over and rebuilding that expensive detector. I'm making a bunch of guesses on this one, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, it's a shame they were ready to go. It's designed, the whole spacecraft is not designed, and even looks like the Phoenix mission that went to Mars, I think that was in 07. That was very successful when Phoenix went there. And so they were ready to go. NASA was ready to go. But one of the contractors is, the French space agency is involved, and they just cannot get this thing tight. And it's not big. It's only 10 inches in diameter. And you would think, well, that's not much of an area to work with. You got to be able to see where the problem is. And they have a series of, two or three detectors inside this thing. And I still haven't figured out why they need this vacuum. I don't know what the material is even made out of. I don't know if it's an aluminum sphere, a glass sphere, fiberglass. I don't know if it's a carbon, 3D manufactured ceramic thing. Just don't know. I searched, I don't know how many different websites. I didn't give up. I just ran out of time. Eventually, I'll come across what this sphere is made out of, It's hard to believe that they can't get the desired number, but whatever it is, they couldn't. Back to you, Dick.
With a good old can-do ham radio experience is not the right word, a way of doing things, we ham radio operators, if faced with that problem, Paul, We would simply build another sphere around that one and make sure that the new one is well sealed. So don't bother sealing all this intricate hardware inside. Just build another cage around it. That's what we do with our transmitters that are not well shielded. You just build another cage around the transmitter. But because it is a detector and maybe some kind of infrared, optical, or whatever energy has to get into that detector, the new cage we build on the outside also has to have a window. And maybe there's the problem, to create a bigger ball around the leaky ball or the leaky multiple balls inside and make sure you've got a window that passes the stuff you want to detect. I think you told me it was a seismometer, but maybe it is some kind of a radion or something that like a bolometer, measures very small amounts of energy by thermal means. So, and maybe some of the most detecting seismometers, and maybe really it is a gravity detector. You know that for some time, the United States, let me drop it. The United States has been navigating our submarines around the world by looking at the gravity gradient. In other words, there are mass concentrations, known mass concentrations, in a whole lot of places on planet Earth. So as you drive your submarine around with a very sensitive gravity detector, you recognize the pattern of the real estate you've just moved over, and the computer says, yeah, I recognize that pattern. You're 150 miles off the east coast of Maine, because it knows what the patterns under the water are going to look like. So is it a gravity detector? Is it a radiometer? Is it a seismometer? Any idea what the detector on what's the name of this thing again? Something, InSight, yeah. The InSight mission. What's the nature of that detector, if you happen to know, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, InSight, it's one of their acronyms. They love that. One of those real long ones. Interior exploration, using seismic investigation, and a couple of other words which I forgot, but I know seismic is, it's a, they want to test the, you know, any kind of movement within the inside of Mars. So just like you have detectors here on Earth, this is a real highfalutin one, so they'll be able to tell if there's any kind of activity under the surface of Mars. That's the goal. And they had about half a dozen different types of these instruments. This one in the sphere, they had two or three detecting type of things that are involved with the sphere, but there's other ones that they were going to have a robotic arm take something and put it on the surface of the planet. Another type of thing was going to drill a couple of meters, I think three meters into the surface, and they're going to have a detector put in that location, and so it was designed for that. It would have all worked except for the sphere, I think. They couldn't hold the pressure. So some type of seismograph system back to there.
Let's see if we have anyone on frequency. That while we got Paul at the tail end of Space Report number 181. You guys, any further questions for him on any of the spacecraft, anything that goes on in space? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, just for entertainment. Why, Mickey, where is Spyro?
Okay. I didn't hear what that question was, Wes, so maybe change the wording and try again. Over to you, Wes, K2LAW.
Keyway Spiral. Try to entertain you guys.
Yeah. After the Big Bang, when all this material started coalescing into what used to be called island universes, why are they spiraled? I'm going to make some guesses on this one. and I'll pass it over to anybody who wants to add to it. I've got a whole bunch of dust, pebbles, call it what you like, floating in free space, where the only thing that's determining